said they enjoyed it, so we thought we'd bring you back in our month of heritage this year. Let's get started by saying, where's your family from, and how did your family come to be here?
Well, my dad and mother come from Italy, and they met in Wisconsin, I think. It was my dad was running a fruit stand there in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dad heard about this area over here, you know, the Chelan area was, it was quite a lot of talk about that over there, what a nice climate it was. So he come out here, and then he decided to homestead here.
Mm-hmm.
And after after he homesteaded, then he went back there, and that's when he got married, I believe.
I see.
He hadn't proved up on the homestead yet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he had laid claim to it.
Mm-hmm. When would that have been when he first came here, do you know?
Well, it was, it seems to me it was 1892, or about the time Whaley was here. I remember him talking, there was just four, Whaley and was one of them here.
Mm-hmm.
At that time. And there was no road between here and Wenatchee. It was trail most of the way, lot of the way. I remember him talking about coming from Wenatchee on horseback and stuff, you know, a lot of and there was Indians along the way too, you know, and, and this squaw was she had her papoose right along the trail.
Is that right?
Yeah. I remember him telling him about that.
Yeah, yeah.
She just got off her horse and had her little papoose and bundled him up a little later and just went on.
Hmm. Well, now, where did he? Where was his homestead?
Up here in Union Valley.
Started out in Union Valley, huh?
Huh?
So your family started out there right from the very beginning then, huh?
Well, before, they lived here in town before he proved up on the place, you know, that he's got the amount of work that you have to do, you know, before you can get the deed and that stuff, whatever the law requires.
Yeah, I think they had to have a building.
They were living here in town, and the first, the oldest daughter was born here in town. The rest of us were all born up in Union Valley.
Why would your father select a homestead site in an area where there was no water at all, instead of down along the Columbia or along the lake, as most people
That's what I've often wondered. Why he didn't, I don't know whether it was all Indians here or what, why he didn't get closer to the lake or something like that, you know. But when he, by the time he was decided to homestead up there, why, most of the area up there was already taken, and nobody seemed to want this in there where he was, where he got this. And it isn't all in a block, you know. It's kind of spread out, and everything is taken on the sides, and so that was about all that was left, and he took that.
Did he ever tell you much about who was in Union Valley at the time he arrived and that kind of thing? Or do you remember any stories that he might have told about that?
The only person that I think was here was up here at where Folletto's place is, at Pistone. I don't know. It seemed to me he was here, or come very shortly, and it also Reuben, I believe Reuben was here, and don't know. I think Filetto's come later.
Yeah.
But they all associated because they were, you know, some of them couldn't speak English very well and stuff, and they were Italians, see?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they associated with their kind a lot more than anybody else, you know.
Well, would it be fair to say that Union Valley was initially basically an Italian community? Would that be accurate, do you think? An Italian immigrant area where they just tended to go because that's where people from their country were from or went?
No, I don't think it was quite that. Because as I remember, there was only four Italian families here. That is, that associated. Farther back there in Union Valley, of course, it come later, I believe.
Yeah.
Is it was people from England and like that, you know, English and I don't know what else.
What their nationalities might
be. Yeah, their nationality.
What are your earliest memories as a boy?
Huh?
What are the earliest things you remember from your boyhood?
Well, I tell you, the one thing that really was outstanding in those days was we never spent much time in town. About twice a year, we come to town. Dad would get the whole bunch of us. There was eight of us kids, you know. And I think it was on 4th of July, and then another time, he'd bring us to town, and he called us his Little Red Apple Crew, because they all had orchards up there, you know. They all planted orchards
yeah.
in those days.
Yeah.
And they were, one thing I can remember very plainly is how strict they were about who we associated with, you know. And everybody had to be on the up and up, you know, really good characters and not inclined towards running around at night or, you know.
Kind of a strict upbringing.
Thieving and that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I remember there was one boy, I don't know whether he was just naturally had to do everything different than anybody else, but if they saw us just talking to him, associating with him, you know, boy, we really got it. You know, they didn't yeah. want no no chance of us ever getting involved in anything like he would do, you know.
Well, then, Raph, can we safely say that you grew up without ever getting into any trouble at all as a boy?
Well, but
maybe a little
for quite a while publicly, but we got into a lot of trouble at home, you know. Like one day, a brother younger than me, Dad had the horses in the barn, you know, and there was a lot of corn out in the feedlot right in front, you know, the feed manger. And we were there feeding the horses ear corn.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Boy, did he ever give us a tanning.
Did the horses survive?
Yeah.
All right.
No, we never overfed them.
But you were feeding them the ear corn, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. How about school? What did you do for schooling as a young boy?
Well, there was a school district up there, and we were in that district, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we came to school in Chelan. All of us never. We all started school here in Chelan. It was too far, really, to go to the school up in Union Valley.
Where was that school?
It was.
Was it way back in, or
way back? Yeah, way back up there. I don't know who is right close there. I think one of the Simmons boys owns some property right near where the school was. He don't live there. He's up in Alaska now working, but he's bought that place, and there's water there. You got a spring of water.
Yeah. Well, when you went to the grades in grade school, did you come to Chelan for that too? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
And where I went, the first grade was over here. The building has been torn down. You know where Smith Electric was and that laundromat?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the building where I went to school was right on the corner there. And we went upstairs, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Getting to school must have been kind of a chore from that distance.
Well, we walked. We walked all the time. Except in real severe winters and deep snow and that kind of stuff, you know. And Dad would hook up the team and take us. Bring us to school in the severe winter, you know.
Yeah.
And when it was real zero weather and that kind of stuff, why we'd heat a bunch of brick on the stove before we'd leave and put them in the sleigh, you know, to keep our feet warm.
And good idea.
One time, the bricks were a little bit too hot, and some of the hay and straw there caught fire.
Oh, no.
You know, but where the brick sat on the stove was real hot enough that it started the straw and stuff afire.
Do you remember your first grade teacher?
Mrs. George. There was two sisters. Mm-hmm. I don't remember their first name, but their last name was George. And one of them was my first grade teacher, and I think the other one, her sister, was a second grade teacher. And there was Mrs. Smith that most of the other kids, the kids older than I, had her for their first grade teacher. She was pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. What was your teacher like? Were teachers
Park Smith? She was a Mrs. Park Smith. I don't know whether you know about them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But with your teacher, what was she like? Were teachers pretty rough? What was it like to go to school?
No, I don't remember. They paddle you know, if you get out of line or something, yeah. Cutting up with other kids or something. But
What did you use for books? Did you use the old McGuffey's readers that we hear about in history courses today?
Yes, I think so. And then there was a spelling. Spelling book was. I can't remember the name of that, but that was a. A little blue book, thin, kind of a pretty good size, you know, length and width, but not very thick.
Did your school term last as long as it does now, from Labor Day to Memorial Day, basically? September through May or June? How long did you go to school?
Well, it seems to me that school was out earlier in the spring than it is now. I don't think we went to school up till June. You know, like,
yeah. If you had to pick a favorite boyhood friend, did you have a favorite friend in school? A lot of people do. I was just wondering if you did.
Well, I had one that when I was in the first grade over here, you know, and every noon hour, and he was more city, you know, more
city kid,
around the city, even though he lived up in the country over here. We used to go around town. Him and I, and he knew his way around, you know, he'd go into these stores and things, and there was over here just about a door or two east of the where the museum building there, there was a little hole in, you know, a little place there where I think it was a little store. Or it seems to me it was kind of a bake or a feed lunch place. I think the lady, she was an old, kind of a heavy-set lady, was in there, and this boy, we went in there one day, and she was making peanut butter. She had a big kettle of peanut butter on the stove, stirring it, you know, and I remember her dipping out some hot, warm peanut butter and giving us some on a paper cone or something.
I'd like to have some of that now.
And, you know, I talked with a lot of guys that were should have been around at that time, and they refuse to believe that there was such a place right there, that close, you know. But some of them, I got an old friend over here in Seattle. He used to be here. He lived over here on a place for 60-some years, and he's over in Seattle there. Near his kid now, he's 88 years old, and I asked him about that, and he says, "You betcha." He says, "I remember that. That's a fact that place was there." See,
one thing I did want to ask you, Steve Bykus has come over, and I know he has questions for you too. But recently, looking through the old newspapers, I saw a gimmick that C.E. Whaley used to try to get customers in. It was right about the turn of the century, and I don't know how long he had it. But it was a brand new invention, they called it, and they didn't even have a name for it at the time. We later came to know it as a Nickelodeon. But you could go in, put a nickel in the machine, and not only did it play your favorite song for you, but you also got a nickel's worth of candy. Do you remember that?
No.
Okay.
No, and it was probably one of those cylinder type things.
Mm-hmm.
It played the cylinder type records.
It must have been at that time because it was. Might have even gone in before the turn of the century. One other thing that that the Whaley store used to do that you may remember, I don't know. In order to control flies in the summertime, they put bullfrogs in the store. You remember stores doing that?
No, I don't. I never seen any in there. Yeah. Anyway, no. The thing I remember in that store that was used to control flies was these ribbons, you know, they hang down from they hang them where they're out of anybody getting into them, and the fly, it was that sticky fly paper,
yeah.
Ribbons.
Yeah. Okay. Steve, welcome aboard.
Old Whaley, he was quite a guy, you know. I remember Terry Cox, you know, he worked, this was the lumber yard where he worked here, Chelan Lumber. And Whaley would walk to work from over across the river there in South Chelan where they lived quite a bit of the time. He walked to work. And he was a little short guy, real white-headed. And I remember Terry said that Whaley... He'd never look at anybody. He was just going to his store, and he'd walk so many steps and then turn right into the. Figured he had the distance stepped off about just like that. He just he wouldn't even hardly turn his head when he turned into the store.
Well, he'd been here for quite a while.
He made a I'll say he was.
Steve, I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute and let you fire some questions here.
I'm sorry, Scott. I didn't get to hear the first little bit of the program, so I don't know how far what you talked about. You talk about, let's see, your family, if I'm not mistaken, was involved in the brick-making business for a while, right?
Yeah.
Most of the buildings around town, in fact, are bricks out of your family's, what do you call it?
Yeah, a fireplace or a chimney or something. There's quite a bit of them, quite a lot of them around.
You work there?
Huh?
Do you work in that business?
You bet. And when Dad, you see, he had a little experience of that before he come here, back in Italy somewhere. Is where he, and he always had that on his mind, I guess. And when he homesteaded that place, he found this clay, see. And so he decided he wanted to make some brick. But he had no machinery to mix it, you know. It had to be, and because the clay for brick has to be pretty well mixed, you know, tempered. And he, where this clay was, he'd use the team, you know, and bring in a pile of that stuff, and then throw water on it, and he built a little corral-like thing around the pit.
Yeah.
And then he'd turn four or five horses in there to stir that, to mix it, you know.
Mm-hmm,
to and you know, and then they'd take he had a platform where he'd wheel this muck out. The mud,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the guys had guys working around this platform. And the pot of clay would be right in the middle, the mud,
yeah.
And they'd reach in there and pull over a bunch and mold it into, you know, kind of shape it up. And then they'd slam it in the mold. They had the three brick molds, just three bricks. And they'd kind of shape this up so it would go into them, and they slam it, see,
yeah.
and then turn it off. See. Well, I remember that that platform had a knot hole in it, you know, and it was come out from the slope, see,
uh-huh.
the hill slope down like that, and you just build it out so it was level, and there was room under there. And us kids used to go under there all the time, you know, when them guys were working, just and. I remember I could see they was pulling this mud over, you know. They'd reach out to the middle and pull a clump of that mud over to shape it. And I stuck my finger up through that knot hole. And, man, one of them got caught me like that. And he held me there for a long time. You know, just...
In your older years, as you grew a little bit older, you ended up having to actually work in the brick process, right? In making the brick, what was the process?
Yeah, well, we did after we grew up. We had we got a kind of a horse-powered mixer thing. It was a big square bin, and we'd shovel, and it had shaft straight down the middle and with blades going out, you know, from the shaft to cut the, as it turned around, and there was a horse had a big sweep where he hooked the horse over here, and he would go around and around, see, and these knives would cut that that mud and mix it.
You weren't doing all of that up at the home, were you?
Huh?
You weren't doing all that up at the ranch, were you? Didn't you end up moving to making brick down here in downtown too?
No.
It was all up in the valley.
It was all up there on the homestead, see, where we made it.
Yeah.
But there was old Gene Dunham. He had a brickyard down here right on the river in South Chelan.
Yeah. See. That was by the bridge, wasn't it? The Dunham brick.
It's above the new bridge up there.
Okay.
From the where the new bridge is in there somewhere, right on the river, and he was getting his clay. It was a kind of a blue clay, where this clay up there is a red clay. His clay was a kind of a blue clay, and he was getting it pretty close to the river, and maybe he got some right out of the river bed.
What kind of?
And we wound up then when the dam was built, you know. He had to move that.
Yeah.
See, he had to fold that up, and we got that outfit from him.
Oh.
See, yeah, that's where we got that horse-powered outfit that
uh-huh.
went around
uh-huh.
and around, and then the pallets to lay the brick on to dry out in the yard and stuff.
What buildings around here are built with brick that you might have made, you and the family?
Well, that Kelly's Hardware. That the part next to the church there, That was it was 28 feet there. Jim Reed built that building.
Yeah.
And it was 28 feet that he built a brand new building there. And that's all. We furnished the brick for that. And of course, they've expanded east of there, you know. That 28 feet that joins the
Mrs. Dodge is
the
going
church
to the post
property
office
there,
Safeway,
built with our brick.
And Rosen Escort is going to Seattle first,
and then there's
and
a house
then the
across
Christian Church
from where it used to be the steakhouse.
Yeah, Uncle Bub's.
Uncle Bub's, right across the street from Uncle Bub. That's brick we made, but that's not a solid brick house. It's a veneer brick veneer.
You remember? Well, after you got the brick made up, delivering it downtown, loading it up, and bringing it down to customers, did you get involved in that part of the business?
I don't remember. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we had an old Model T truck that we delivered brick with. And then, but when we sold the brick for the hardware over here, we hired them hauled.
That was probably a pretty good sized job for you, huh?
Oh yeah, it was. I forget how many 100,000 brick went in there. And then that Perry House.
Yeah.
Out there that I was telling you yesterday about. You know that big archway? Mm-hmm. And all that brickwork there, we made those brick too. That archway and the entrance, you know, it's all brick. Old Potter, he was the mason, the brick mason that built that, you know, and he hand-picked those brick. As we'd deliver them, he'd pick out certain brick for that purpose. He was saying them to put there to face that archway with the certain color, you know,
stuff. You, I don't know that I'm right on this, but if I've talked to you before, and I've got the impression that perhaps in those years, rather than making brick and delivering brick and working and doing that kind of stuff and being here in town, you'd just as soon been out in the hills hunting or doing something else. Is that right?
Oh yeah, I always loved that part. That you know, I never was attracted to be in the city life and stuff. Never attracted me.
You have electricity yet?
Yes.
You did? Hey, that's great. I didn't know.
But I don't have any phone, though. Oh. And then I haven't hooked up the phone. It goes right by there, but...
I think the first time we talked, you didn't have electricity yet, did you? Maybe you did. On the shop. I don't know.
I think so, because that's the first thing I done when I moved in there. You know. I put all that... I climbed those poles... to hook that wire up to run over to the house, you know, from the meter pole, and
what's up?
I was so dumb, you know. I had a pair of climbers, but I had never noticed how these guys climb poles and how they use that safety belt, you know, and until afterwards. But I thought it was just for after you get up there, you buckle that belt to
hold yourself,
so you can work, and it holds you. And I climbed that pole without buckling that belt.
You're lucky you didn't fall over backwards.
Really, and slip. You know, you're supporting one of those climbers with a slip. And I noticed that I was watching a guy climbing a pole, and he had this safety belt around the pole, and he'd move it up a little bit and then step up and move it up.
It's a terrific labor-saving device, right?
Boy, oh boy.
I want to talk a little bit about farming and ranching. I don't know if you're still doing it, but you've always done a little bit of dry land farming up there.
Yeah.
You got water yet? Not gonna.
Well, I'm using it.
Reclamation water.
When.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't use very much. That is, I don't. I just use enough for. If I don't have any good moisture, you know, or deep, down deep, then I'll use the irrigation water, because I like to farm the dry land method.
Right. That dry land method's changed, though, because the weather's changed. Has the weather changed?
Yes, it has. In fact, it has changed so much that I can't even... Look ahead to contemplate what kind of weather might be in the future or coming. Now, like this year, look, here we are in the month of March, and we haven't had a gust of wind or nothing. And usually, boy, when March breaks in, we have a lot of that. I don't know what that saying is, whether March comes in like a lion, out like a lamb, or in like a lamb and out like a lion, but... It has to be in like a lamb this year, because it's here come in a mild way.
Okay, let's talk about the weather a little bit. Up there, when you were really extensive dry land farming and basically growing, I guess, organically, which you're still doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Used to have really good winters up there, a snowpack, and had a lot of moisture to work with. What's your soil moisture like now up there? Have you had in the past 5 years or even 10 years good soil moisture like you used to have?
10 years? Well, we did have there for 2 or 3 years in a row. Well, it was, you know, 56 was one. 55 and 56, the winter. We had a nice snow, and it all went in the ground.
Yeah.
It was a good winter. That was a lot of moisture that year. And then it seemed like there was a little bit of intermission there. And then we had 2 or 3 more good years of deep snow, you know. In fact, it was there for a while. It looked like it might have been a change coming, a cycle, going back to the old times when we could just figure on a lot of snow every winter.
How much snow have you seen standing up there at your place before? Maybe, you know, a couple, 3 feet more?
Yes, I've seen it there where it was over the fences. You could just see the tips of the fence poles. You wouldn't see no wire at all. You walk right over the fences. But in the spring, that is when it would crust over.
Yeah.
But I don't remember that I ever measured, to know exactly how deep it was. But there was times when there was 4 feet of snow there.
You used to be able to take a look at winter and do whatever else you did and forecast weather pretty accurately. I remember when we talked 5, 6 years ago, you were pretty much right on. You say you can't do that anymore?
No, I can't. Like now, you see, it's so up in the air that I can't believe that it's going to go right on and into summer. From what we've got,
yeah.
Because it come about in a, you know, we used to have a lot when the winter would break up, like in February, and when the snow would start, we'd have some hot days, and the snow would melt. And if it was frozen, the ground was frozen or something like, then it would we'd have the runoff, you know, and we could we'd see a lot of floods running in these valleys and things, you know.
Yeah.
But anymore, it doesn't break up like that, you know. Not that is it. It isn't a regular occurrence.
Yeah.
Where it used to be, you could figure around the middle of February, along in there, that when there was a break in the weather, then you would have this sunny days and you know, and melting and then freezing at night and that kind of stuff. But anymore, I just can't look ahead and have a feeling, have that feeling of. Of what's coming, you know. Of what?
What's that done to your ability to raise crops and stuff? Are you raising more or less?
Less. Now here, it was 3 years ago, I believe. Yeah, it was in the fall. That is, it was a dry. We had a dry season, I believe, and. We were approaching the fall, and it looked like I had a hunch. See, that it come to me then to soak the ground, use the irrigation water to where I was going to plant watermelon the next year. See, it was a stretch of piece of ground I had from the roadway in there that I was figuring on planting. Sweet corn and melons and that kind of stuff, squash and whatnot, but it didn't look like there was going to be any natural moisture, any winter moisture.
Mm-hmm.
So I got that idea. So I thought, well, I better turn the water on that piece of ground and get my moisture down deep in case that there is no snow this winter.
Yeah.
See, so then next spring I can get right on it and. Dry land farm, and I'd have moisture down deep. Well, I done that. I kept that the sprinklers running there until they shut the water off. You know, just kept rotating and letting it soak down. Got her really soaked. But you know, speaking of activity, slowing down and stuff. The next spring, when spring broke, I never got out there to. Never planted it. Can you imagine? And it was right on. I really had the right hunt because it was an ideal watermelon year. Dry, hot summer. You know, really.
We're
and then last year, I planted them.
Yeah.
And then I had very few real good old type melon that I know how to grow.
Yeah, you're good. Pretty famous for your melons.
Oh man,
I got a couple stories about your melons.
I had, yeah. There was other people interested in them.
Yeah, we'll get back to that.
I raised a 41-pound melon up there.
You kidding?
Dry land.
41.
41 pounds. It was this. The name of them is Crimson Sweet. That's the variety. You see them. There's a lot of them in the markets here. They're round and striped, light green. Yeah.
41 pounder. We're going to come.
And it was very. Market wasn't very good that year either.
Raise the big melon
at
the low price,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. When I was really raising the melon, why, there was no market like there is now. And now I've lost my grip and I. And then the weather is kind of adverse, too.
Yeah. We're going to take a commercial break. Be right back. I want to talk about some melons here. Shannon, it's yours for a minute or two. Mind if we talk about your melon stories?
No. Heck no. Let's see. There was something come up... not just too long ago. It was a gal with no, I guess it wasn't about the melon. I was thinking it was connected to the melon, but it wasn't. Lund. Lund that was here, electrician?
Terry.
Yeah. His daughter, you know, I had their horses up there, and they were just little kids. He had these kids, and he'd bring them up there, and he'd put two or three of them on a...
You pick up the cue.
He'd put two or three of them on a horse, you know, and by golly, now she's married, and her and her husband had bought a place up here, and I didn't know who she was. They'd stop there and buy a bale of hay and this and that. They had goats and that all that time. I never did know who she was. And it was just, I think, last summer when that she told me that it come about.
There's something else I want to talk about, then I got to get going. We're live again this morning at the Crockery and talking this morning with Raph St. Louis about some of his adventures in Union Valley. Scott Brundage here, and Steve Bykvist is with us too. So, Steve, I'll turn it back to you.
Raph, I think the first time I met you, as I remember, was a sunny afternoon at your place.
And,
we were told that you had a building up there. There's some snowmobile races up there back, I don't know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, and that building was for sale, and we needed a small building on top of Chelan Butte, so we came up to negotiate with you a little bit on that building. By the way, the building was successfully moved to the top of Chelan Butte. But, and we were told when we went up there, you know, to talk to you, that better be a little bit cautious. That guy, you know, don't get along with people too terribly well, and he's known to carry a gun, and all sorts of stories. And you were like a living legend, you know, and we... And I remember with Jer Eisenhart, and we came up, and we were treading kind of lightly around your place there when it turns out that you were probably more conversant than we were, and were certainly more hospitable than we expected. And I think perhaps some of the stories that we had heard about you was because of that... some incidents involving the melons that we were talking about, maybe.
Yeah, could be.
I know that you had people that had eye on your melons, and they were coming up at night or something.
Oh, you bet. They were. In fact, I built me a little cabin-like thing down at the lower end down there with bales of hay. Stacked them up, you know, and then put a roof on them. And it looked like a little act. Nobody knew that I had a cot in there, and that's where I'd go when I'd suspected somebody would be up, or when they got started running pretty regular. Well, I just, after the evening, I just go down there and lay down there and read or something until it come dark, and then I'd be in there when they and... Well, I'll tell you, there were some experiences there. It was on a Saturday night. There were five or six kids come up there.
Yeah.
They hired a kid with a car to bring them up there. And when he stopped the car, and he stayed in the car, but when he stopped the car, they all just piled out and jumped over the fence and started out in the melon patch, see? And I stepped out of there with my shotgun, and I I stopped them.
Yeah, I'll bet you did.
I held them there for an hour or more, you know. And I wanted that kid's, the kid that was driving the car, I wanted his name and the car license and everything. And I held them there, and finally, every once in a while, one of them, you know, he'd say, well, can we go now? No, I said, you can't go. I said, I want that... his name and the car license. By golly, you know, it was an hour or more before they finally gave in to giving me his name and address, and the license of the car. See, Because they wanted to know why, if I was going to go to the law or something. No, I said, it just if something happened. I said, I want to have something to go on. And I'll not never... but you see, they... after I stopped, caught them, see, then they tried to tell me that they weren't after melons. It was on a Saturday night, see?
Yeah.
And they said they weren't... after melons, and because they said they had a deal, they were all going to meet up at the Bible camp, and they were going to have beer and women and whatnot, and they said, what would we want watermelon when we're going to have a party up there, and beer and girls? Well, I said, it's funny. I said that you would stop at them. I said, there's somebody in your crowd likes watermelon, or you would never stop to meet here at a melon patch. They called it they called it the haystack. They were going to meet at the haystack.
Did you ever fire a gun over anybody's heads or
in
the air or anything?
You betcha. And I fired right at them too. The guy that I shot over his head was, you see, they'd come up the road, they'd drive up to the top of the grade and leave the car, and then they'd walk up the road.
Yeah.
And then they got so they'd leave the car down below. They wouldn't get on top of the flat there at all and leave it down below and walk up the grade and walk up. And then they quit using the road, and this night they come up the field, out in the field, and they were all strung out. I forget, I could see them, and there was four or five of them, you know, and they were so many feet apart.
Yeah.
Every once in a while there was a guy, and now farther back there was another one, and this guy in the lead, he come up, and I had a little corn and other stuff planted before you got to the melon patch at the end.
Yeah.
Well, he walked right up and walked through this corn and squash or whatever it was, and he stopped right on the edge of the melon patch. Stood there. He just stood there, never moved. And I was watching him, and by golly, he wasn't. And when he'd stop, all of them would stop. See, that's the way they had it planned. And by golly, finally I got tired waiting, so I shot right over his head. And, you know, he just, he busted out laughing just as loud as he could laugh and turned around and went back laughing.
Undoubtedly, that's probably where we'd heard these stories about you then.
Yeah, the gun part, I think, would have probably originated there. Because, but I shot at them, you know, when they get out at a good distance. I let them have the baby. I let them, because one night there was, summer I was thinning apples up here for Schultz.
Yeah.
And there was a kid working there, and we were talking. No, it wasn't thinning. We were propping. I think I was helping him prop. And I asked him if he knew me. And he says, no, but he said, I heard about the melon patch. And I said, was you one of them? And he said, no. But he said, one night I was going home late after midnight, and he said there was... There at that little highway market, there was a couple of kids there with their shirt off and comparing their BB marks, he said. They were inspecting their BB.
Do you think that after
so
this...
No, I did score.
After this happened a couple of times, do you think it tended to keep people from coming up there and doing it, or do you
think
they start playing a game with you?
It was more of a challenge. There were some of them had ideas, and then there was a couple of them had ideas to bring their girls and let the girls go. They had the girls come up to the melon patch.
First.
And then they even come up clear on the other side. Approach the melon patch from the east side. See? And they got some melons when they done that. And because I found the melons busted over on the road there where they had their car parked. After they got to the car and they opened up the melons and stuff. You know. But, you know, I quit that. There was a guy, I was telling him, you know, I'd come down and tell him about them kids coming up there and me shooting at them and stuff. And finally one guy told me, he says, Raph, he says, you got a right to protect your property. But he says, you're shooting at these kids, he says, with that shotgun. And he says, he said, one of these times, he says, just when you shoot, one of those kids are going to be turning his head back and he gets a BB in the eye, and he says,
yeah, then you'd probably be in trouble.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought that over, and then I figured he was right, you know. And he said, you don't get no fair shake in a court either, you know. They just really hack you.
Mm-hmm.
So then I tried to get Safeway interested in the melons over here, you know, because they had several stores, and I had a truck loads of them, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought if they would be interested, they could peddle them to, you know, supply some of their other stores. But they wouldn't go for it, so I went to Wenatchee, and I got, there was a market down there at that time, and I took some samples with me. Took some big ones and little ones and all the different kinds.
Yeah.
And so they bought them. And they sent a truck up there and they hauled them off. They hauled off. They figured they could haul all the big melons in three loads, and then they were going to they stockpiled the little ones. They'd get them later. Well, they never did come after the little ones. And they never hauled all the big ones in three truckloads. They didn't get them all. But they...
Did they buy your whole crop from you?
Yeah, right here? Yeah. I lumped it off to them. And when they had when I brought them the sample down there, they couldn't believe that I had that many melons that good. See?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they said they had to come up and they wanted to make sure that they were there. And I said, okay. And they said they'd be up at the buyer, they couldn't buy anything. See, the produce department, they couldn't buy anything without his okay. That was it. So they said, leave us some melons and we'll... He wasn't there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can give him a sample, and then call us at 8 o'clock, see? And we'll know by 8 o'clock. So I went home, and then I kind of went out, and I was estimating how many melons I had. So when I called them, I could tell them, see?
Yeah.
And heck, here it was, just a little after 6, and here they come, see? And so I took them out and showed them the melon, see? And they couldn't find a melon that wasn't ripe, you know, that was really... And so they bought them.
Hmm. Right there on the spot?
Yeah.
The stuff you're growing now, where do you market it? How do you, you know, the melons and the whatever you're growing now? I don't know. You still doing melons?
Well, not very regular. Here one year I had I planted a lot of watermelon and cantaloupe, and then these Crenshaw melons.
Uh-huh.
And of course I got apples too. I established a market for my apples over there on the coast, my apples were wormy. They weren't very good. I couldn't sell them. Because I had the idea an organic-minded person wouldn't mind a wormy apple, you know. But I found out that they were just as finicky as the rest of them.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I had these melons, and I had some of the earlier apples, so I'd take a load over, you know, apples and melons. And I'm telling you, I never saw people so overwhelmed when they tasted those melons. You know, I'd take them in and I'd tell them to cut one open and taste it. And they just couldn't believe it. You know. And those Crenshaw melons, I let them ripen right on the vine. You know, you could smell them for 25 feet or more before you got to them. And they just, it just floored them, I'm telling you.
So you're still hauling over the coast some of this stuff?
Yeah, everything, mostly. You know, I got customers to come up there, you know, that get some stuff. But mostly, any amount, it goes over there.
You're still all organic and as much dry land as you can?
Yes, you betcha.
How'd you get the worms out of your apples?
I got a sprayer, and I knew there was this all organic spray, you know, that wasn't chemical, and it wasn't toxic to humans. But I didn't have a sprayer, see. And then I found out the young guy out here, Manson, he was organic, and he had a sprayer. So I went out and I just got on my knees practically. I wanted to hire him to come and spray mine or anything, I said, to get mine sprayed, see. So he told me I could use his sprayer if I took care of it and so on. And I'd done that until I picked up an old sprayer, and then I was on my own.
Yeah.
So I got them under control, see.
Huh.
But I really had them. It was a lot of work to get them under control, but I got them.
Springtime's about here. What are you going to plant this year?
Well, it was... I was down with Wenatchee. I had to go down to the doctor down there. I had a little trouble this winter, and coming home, I picked up a hitchhiker, you know, just out of Wenatchee.
Yeah.
And he had been down there, and his car broke down, you know. And in our conversation coming home, he said we were talking about the weather, you know, and he said he thought it was going to be a real dry, hot summer. Well, I said, I better plant some watermelon.
So you're going to plant melon this year?
I think so. I got a lot of seed.
Okay.
And it's pretty good moisture.
Raph, when we first talked to you 10 years ago up at your place and talked to you on the radio a couple times, you didn't have any neighbors to speak of, right?
No,
close.
No. No.
Now you got neighbors.
I was really, I'm telling you, Bohan, I was really an outcast or whatever.
Hermit.
When you guys come up there. You know, I really tickled about when you and Jer were up there. I remember Jer, you guys sat down on the ground there, you know?
Yeah.
And Jer told me about, you know, like that you just told me a while ago about hearing that I was a gun-toting tough son of a gun. And Jerry says, I remember him saying, he said, you notice, he said, we got down on the ground.
I remember that real well. What do you think now? Your valley up there, you know, had... basically, your family living in it, in the area that you're at now, and now you got, you know, things are sprouting up around you, new homes are going, and people are living further up than you are, and all that. But what do you think of that?
Well, I tell you, I like to see these young guys, these young people, interested to go out there like they do, you know, and really. Rough it and wanting to really do something, really interested, and that's one thing I was pretty provoked about in the winter when they had a bad winter or something and they couldn't get in and out, see, and they couldn't get the county to help them with the road, see, and I I really been concerned about that. We had a meeting down here with the commissioner, and I don't know whether the engineer was there or what, but about the road, you know. And I asked the commissioner, you know, he was telling about the county, what they, and I asked him if the county didn't have in their future plan or what to expand, you know, that if they a good road would promote you know,
more people,
more people, yeah, and inhabitants and stuff. The way it's been, well, I brought out the fact that right below me there, see, until that was subdivided, the road was all alike all the way to town, just a gravel, rocky, bumpy road, see? And then all of a sudden, when that was subdivided, I said, we have an A1 road. How come? I said. And, see, instead of waiting until the people move in, why not
do it ahead of time?
Have a little better access, you know, so to invite them.
Yeah.
To be, you know.
So you'd like to see...
Promote them.
You'd like to see more people up there. And,
you bet.
Yeah, okay. So I've got to get going. I've got an appointment, but Scott's got some more questions that he wants to ask you, I know. We've been talking more present, and I think he probably wants to talk a little more past.
Yeah, I want to dig into your closet and see what's in there, Raph, you know, so you want to be careful. You're going to be the old hard-nosed investigator here now. Well, you were talking earlier in the program, Raph, about some of the your earlier experiences in school and so on. I recently read a novel by James Michener that dealt a lot with dry land farming, and because it hadn't been worked into a science yet, we wound up in many portions of the West in the Midwest with the Dust Bowl because of the improper method of dry land farming.
Yeah.
Was there an evolutionary process in dry land farming here where folks who started it said, hey, we were wrong here? Did you have a Dust Bowl type problem here at all at any time?
Well, there was a dry cycle, you know, that it was absolutely really dry. It was in the early 30s, I believe. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, the dry land farming is it just seemed like it was it come natural to the old settlers, you know, and I don't know where they got it. Whether the Indians were doing it that way or what, but you know, the quality of the dry land products is quite a lot better than the other.
Well, take me back a ways to where you were a young boy on your farm, and your dad was doing the farming. Can you take me through a growing cycle and tell me what he would have done, what he would have grown, and how he'd grow it?
Well, we had mostly a lot of alfalfa, see? And then he'd plow ground for corn and plant corn. I don't remember we raised much squash. Well, we planted some melons too, but just for our own, you know. Everybody had a melon patch in them days, and that was something else too. That,
well, the cornfields, that would have been you plowed it with a horse, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
How many blades on his plow? Just a single blade plow, or?
Just a single blade plow, and he most of the land that he plowed for corn was hillside. and he used what they call a hillside plow. He would you'd go one way, and when you get to the end of the furrow, you'd flip the plow over. It was one of those plows that flip over, and you could come back in the same furrow without going around the field. See? And on a hillside, you can't go around very easy.
Yeah.
See, you have to zig back and forth and move, work up the hill, up the slope.
Yeah. Wisconsin that we're laying around as relics, but I think probably a lot of people don't really know what a harrow is. Well, can you describe one and what it was for?
Well, it's an iron frame, you know, with the crossbars about 8 or 9 inches apart,
uh-huh.
and each one of these crossbars have holes where the harrow pegs, the part that scratches the ground like a rake. Mm-hmm. These things are fastened on these crossbars. And then an evener is set on it so that they hook up to the horses and stuff and drug over the ground. And it amounts to a dragging rake. So these pegs stick down and break up the clods and fill in, you know, push the ground around holes or anything, well, it'll push dirt in the and level it off, you know, smooth it.
You know, it's amazing how fine it'll grind it too. Because I remember we found a farmer when I was a youngster who had an old time harrow laying around, and we rigged it up to a tractor and used it to build a dirt go kart track. Had a nice smooth track with it too. Little sidelight there, I guess. Raff, quite a while ago in our program here, you mentioned coming to town 2 times a year, basically, for any kind of social events, and one of them was a 4th of July celebration.
Yeah.
Now, I looked in the old papers. I find some 4th of July celebrations that went 4 or 5 days. Would you stay for the whole thing? Did you,
no.
Did you camp downtown?
No. No, we'd camp all that day. You know, mm-hmm. We'd come down, and at that time, at the 4th of July, we had cherries. Dad had a lot of cherries planted up there in the orchard, and he was always watching us to stay away from them cherries until he said they were ready. I remember he'd hold us away from them cherry trees, believe me, we wouldn't hardly ever have a chance to sneak and get them without him knowing, you know. And then when he'd declare the cherries were ripe, I remember one time he was mowing hay. He was on the mower, yeah. And we were around there helping him and stuff. And so he made this announcement that the cherries were ripe and started running for the cherry trees. And we all... And that's one thing that we'd bring to town when we'd come to town on the 4th of July. We had a lot of cherries, you know, and lunch and stuff. You know, stay all day.
What do you remember most about the 4th of July celebrations? What did you enjoy most as a youngster?
Well, they had the rodeos, and of course, there were a lot of firecrackers in them days. You know, anybody could buy firecrackers and set them off and stuff if they had the money. But we never, when we were little, we never had much access to that.
Yeah.
But and there was always a rodeo, or you know, something like that.
We're talking about what now? The 19-teens, when you'd be doing this, coming in as a boy, or.
I suppose it was. There was a rodeo corral right here on this block, mm-hmm. You know, right back of
where the Chevrolet garage is now.
Yeah. I remember the Wapatos had that put that on that year, mm-hmm. and I think John. I believe John was he would announce the horse, you know.
Yeah.
And the rider, in that tub. I believe it was John the Baptist. I believe that was, yeah. And every rider, you know, was all, he'd always announce the horse and then the rider, and he'd always say, give the rider's name and from the reservation, you know, he come from up there. And finally somebody hollered out from the grandstand, says, John, why don't you get some announce some from Manson? And well, he says they eat too many red apples. He figured they weren't good riders. They ate too many apples.
Raph, I've heard that one of the members of your family was quite a runner, and on a 4th of July celebration once or annually or something would take the American flag and run with it. Is there any truth in that?
It seems to me, I don't remember exactly, but there was they'd run up to the top of the butte. One year there was.
That's what I'd heard. That's
I don't remember. Somebody asked me about it. That Hernani, the one that got burned in the, that they thought that he done that one year, but I don't remember that. But he was quite an athlete, you know, and could have been.
Yeah. He graduated from school, I think, in 1927 or so, and then was killed in the fire in 1929, I think.
I think he was in the class of 28.
Was he in the class of 28?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then, I believe his class was 28. And that fall, he went to the university for a semester, I think, just a half. And then he was working out here in an orchard, you know, to figure on going back, because he really made a hit over there in athletics and football. They really had him pinpointed for an All-American.
Yeah, I've read about that.
A top notch.
Yeah.
And that's when he was working in this orchard out here, and that fire broke out, you see. And all the growers, of course, had to, that is, they volunteered to release their help to fight that fire and stuff. And and so he got on that fire, and that was it.
When you went to school, did you participate in athletics or... In high school, what did you do for fun while you were in high school?
Well, I played football, and I participated in everything, but I never was in basketball. I never was. I earned my letter one year, but I wasn't. I was too rough. I couldn't forget my... One coach told me that I couldn't forget my football. Playing basketball.
Yeah. You know, when we go to a high school football game today, we see pretty fancy equipment. Lots of pads and the helmets and all. And
And those face masks.
Yeah. What did you wear then?
Just a padded leather helmet that... come over your ears and a throat latch, you know, to hold it on.
Did you have pads for your knees and your thighs and your rib cage and your shoulders and all that?
We had shoulder pads. And I don't remember that we had knee pads.
Okay, you were in school in what, the late 20s? Somewhere in there, in high school?
See, I stayed out of school 2 years from the eighth grade, and I went to high school in 26.
Okay.
I think.
Now you played other schools in football.
High
then,
school,
right?
26. Huh?
You played other schools in football then, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Do you remember who you played?
Yeah, we played Okanagan, and Wenatchee was always a... well, they were always on the spot. We were always really up for Wenatchee, trying to beat Wenatchee. I don't know how many times Chelan has beat Wenatchee, but it isn't very many times.
Yeah.
And that was one main goal, is to beat Wenatchee. And I remember the last time I played, we were playing them down there, and we were really up to determined to beat them, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And we went down there, and they had a little... I don't know whether he's from Hawaii or what. He was kind of a Chinese...
was that Mr. Dodge?
Oriental fella.
Yeah. And on the Wenatchee backfield.
Yeah.
He was in the Wenatchee backfield.
Uh-huh.
And he was really sharp. Well, anyway, on the kickoff, we were receiving.
Mm-hmm.
They kicked to us, and the ball come down, and our quarterback was closest to the goal post, you know, to the goal, and that ball rolled down there and never crossed the goal line, which made it a live ball.
Right.
Well, none of us knew. And I looked back there, and the quarterback was standing there, and the ball was right in front of him, and the referee was right there. He never said nothing or anything. And here this little Chinese or whatever nationality he was, he run all the way. He was one of the farthest ones back, run all the way down and took that ball and scored a touchdown.
Oh, wow. Right. What did
that was a heartbreaker.
I bet it
that
was, yeah.
That really was a backbreaker.
That started out the game.
Yeah, and here we were all really high up to beat them. They beat us 34-0.
So the best laid plans, you know. How would you get to a ball game in those days? Did they run a bus to a ball game in the 20s? How did you get to the game?
No, there was individual cars.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever... you know, individuals would volunteer to haul players. There'd be four or five cars or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
No, we didn't have... in fact, I don't think we had very many buses, you know, school buses.
Yeah. What position did you play? Were you on the line or in the backfield?
I was in the line... until in 28 when my brother was burned in the forest fire graduated, then in spring football they told me that I had to take his place in the backfield. He was fullback in the backfield, see, and so they were in spring football. They were giving me a chance to get acquainted with that position in the spring practices. See,
yeah,
I never will forget how they were showing me how to hit the line, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they never told me about. keeping my head just right, you know, and I hit that line with my head down, you know, and man, oh man, how did my vertebrae, I can hear them yet. How they cracked.
It only took one time, though, I'll bet you, huh?
Huh?
I'll bet it only took one time.
Yeah, that's right.
Raph, when you were going to school and playing in sports and so on, who were some of your teammates that you remember? Any particularly good athletes that you remember that were in school in the late 20s?
I Well, I don't remember any of them that I played with that even made college athletics, unless it was some individual in track.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't even remember anyone in that.
You know, this year in our heritage programming, we've put quite some degree of emphasis on the water power and the development of water resources here. Your family was, being agriculturally oriented, I'm sure was probably aware of the land around them and so on. Do you remember what the Chelan River was like before it was dammed?
Did you
go down and spend time watching it flow or anything like that?
Yeah, down there, somewhere near where that new bridge is, uh-huh. there was an old wooden bridge there. Mm-hmm. And we used to go down there, and I never did fish, but some of the other kids would fish. And we'd go down there, and it was just like a big creek. I remember, I don't ever remember it really a roaring that I was ever there when it was really high, you know, a roaring big stream.
Yeah.
It always seemed to be kind of a really down. And
so there weren't times in the normal high runoff time of year when you'd go down and just watch it go or something? There weren't many times in the normal high runoff time of year when you just go down and watch it go down the gorge. And stuff.
No, only a time or two. You know, there was so much talk about the down where down there at the gorge.
Yeah.
You know how the water was just a mass of white foam.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
Then I was down there a time or two when in high water when it was really a roaring, you know.
Yeah.
It really was all white from the rough gorge channel there, and
do you remember any periods of major flooding in the time that you've lived here?
No,
in this area.
There was always floods, you know, runoffs. They come down these valleys. But when you was mentioning the flood of, what is it, 1894, mm-hmm. I've been wondering if that was that just in the rivers, or was it because I remember. The folks talking about someone and the old timers talking about a time that it could have been around about that time, or maybe not that far back, but there was a time when they, I don't remember whether it was a cloud burst or whether it was the spring runoff, but up at the upper Union Valley, you know, way up where the loop starts back.
Yeah.
You go up there and you come down in that kind of a meadow place there.
Mm-hmm.
And why there was some people living up in there, and they had this flood come through their house. See, and they had their youngster. They had a child. I don't know what age, but he was in the rocking chair.
Yeah.
And this flood went through that house, and the rocking chair was floating on the flood water going down the valley.
Oh, wow.
And he was in it. I remember him talking about that.
I assume the youngster survived.
Huh?
Did the youngster survive?
Huh. Yes.
It could well have been in 1894, because that was a mixture of runoff and
but
heavy
was,
rain.
It had to be an enormous flood, you know, a real body of flowing water running down through there
Yeah. Well, in that flood, there were people that could stand on the banks of the Columbia and watch buildings that came out of the Okanagan and Mehow valleys flow by down here. So
yeah,
it was a pretty good-sized flood.
Yeah, that was the 48 flood was a little similar to that, mm-hmm. but not as big, mm-hmm. you know, because you could see chicken houses and stuff like that floating and in the 48 flood.
Yeah,
and it'd be different things like pets or chickens or whatever on some of that floating stuff. Going down the river, it come out of the Methow mostly, because it really gouged that Methow Valley river channel there.
Yeah, well, that's another one we hope to do a program on sometime this month, is the flood in 48. Raph, it's we've let time run away from us here, but it's certainly been a lot of fun talking with you, and I hope we can do it again sometime soon.
Yeah. Gee, I didn't know what. But I'll tell you, there's two old timers here that I don't think I think they could have a lot more to say, and that's old Grover Kelly and Artie Garten. They're really loaded with old memories and stuff.
Yeah, they
God,
are.
I enjoyed them guys when they were on.
Yeah, we enjoyed talking with them. Well, maybe we'll have them back, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Raph, for joining us.
Okay, Scott.
Talking this morning with Raph St. Louis, live from the Crockery in Radio Lake Chelan's Month of Heritage, and that about wraps it up for today.
They hadn't fallen asleep over there. They got the cue.
Well, that was fun. I enjoyed that.
You know, there's a guy...